Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Hebron for this session. Just very, very briefly, if it's not obvious, the emergency exits are that side. If anything happens, that one in the middle is really for an emergency exit. So if you want to leave before the end of the session, could you please go out that door there so we can keep track of numbers? The talks, as you probably know, are all being recorded. This one certainly is. So keep that in mind if you'll be enjoying the session today. You can go and order it, of course, in the Greenbelt store. Now, this venue this year is being sponsored by the MediaNet, and Andrew's going to just say a quick word about that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve. Welcome to the tent this afternoon. It's been a long day, hasn't it, for those of us who didn't get much sleep last night, but you're bearing up well by the look of it. Lots of us want to influence the media in the UK to see a better media in the UK, and Christians have tried a number of different strategies for that in the past. Some of them have tried writing letters in green ink to various media outlets. I used to answer some of them when I was a television producer. Some Christians have tried burning their television licenses, but found that it didn't actually impact the media very much at all. My conviction is that if you want to influence the media in the UK, the best way to do it is to love and support and encourage the people who make it. And that's what the MediaNet is about. It's a brand new network launched this very weekend here at Greenbelt. It's a national network to bring together for support and encouragement and fellowship and discipleship Christians and others who work in the media, in television, radio, online, PR and communications, advertising, community media. All those places. If that describes you, if you work in media in some form, or somebody in your family or in your party here, we would love to meet you and say hello. I'm going to be here at the end of this session. I'll come up to the front here. If you'd like to come and say hello, I would be delighted to do that. Even better, you could come and meet us down at our exhibition stand in G-Source, or even better than that, you could come to our launch party tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in the grandstand. So if you'd like to know more about that, if you work in media or know others here who do, please do come and say hello. Now we're going to get on with the business of the session. I'd like you to give a lovely, warm Saturday afternoon Greenbelt welcome to Maggie Dawn.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here this afternoon. It's nice to see so many familiar faces, and some of you I only ever see at Greenbelt, and it's a real pleasure to reconnect with people year by year. You know, I am sure, that there are two great feasts in the church year. One is Easter, of course, and the other is Christmas. And each of those feasts is preceded by a fast. Now, we do often keep the fast of Lent in the 21st century. We tend rather less to keep the fast of Advent, although doing something to keep Advent has become rather back into fashion rather more in recent years, as people, I think, have reacted to the kind of overkill culture of Christmas and wanted to do something, sort of pace themselves through the days running up to Advent. But had you celebrated Lent or Advent in the Middle Ages, it would have been a rather different experience. First of all, you would not have chosen what to give up. I don't know whether people still ask each other the question, are you giving up anything for Lent this year? Do you ever ask that of people at church? Yeah, you do. So I'm not that way out of date then. And, you know, some people might say, well, I'm giving up biting my nails, or I'm giving up beer and wine because it'd be good for my liver, or I'm giving up chocolate because it would be good for my waistline. And sometimes people will say that they're going to do something charitable. But as often as not, it's giving up something, and it seems to be connected to something we feel we ought to do because it would do us good. It would be good for, you know, be good for me to give up chocolate because I'd get better skin, and of course I can draw closer to God at the same time, but it would be kind of good for me. So we choose what we give up. And if you had celebrated Lent in the Middle Ages, you would have had no choice about what to give up. Everybody, rich and poor, throughout the whole of Europe and England, would have given up all dairy foods and eggs and everything that was animal produce, meat and fat, just everything to do with animal and dairy produce. No milk, no cheese, no butter. And particularly in Lent, this is less of an issue in Advent, but in Lent, wasn't too bad if you were rich, because you could use ground almonds and steep them in water and produce a kind of soya milk-like alternative to milk. And you could perhaps eat some raisins and some sultanas. That would help to sustain you. But if you were poor, your choices were basically wrinkled up old apples and cabbage soup. So that would not have been so pleasant. But the community was united because they all fasted together and they all knew what they were signed up for. And they all feasted together at the end of the fast. So there was a sense of community about this fast. And there was also a united community charitable purpose in this fasting, because every household would save money that they did not spend on food, and they would give it away to a good cause. So they would take care of their community by looking after those less fortunate than themselves. Now, when we choose what to give up for Lent, or even whether to give up anything for Lent, we're of course choosing whether we do something to suit ourselves, whether we do anything at all, and it's something different from what everybody else does. So we lack that sense of community togetherness about what we do. And we don't necessarily look to make it a reason to do good to other people. Sometimes we do, but it's not just a given that that's what we do. Now, I am not saying, of course, that we should go back to the Middle Ages or earlier. I've spent some of this summer going on those sort of recreated history things with my 11-year-old son. And apart from catching nits in one of the Norman helmets and other middle-aged experiences, he did really enjoy it very much. And one of the things, actually, it just strikes me looking round at the gathered crowd here today, is that in a Norman church, the people would try to sit near the front. They weren't very Anglican about where they sat. And if they were perceived to be weak or failing or ill, they would be sent to sit by the wall. So that's where the phrase going to the wall comes from. But I noticed that at Greenbelt, it's those who are wealthy enough to own a nice posh little chair who actually sit at the back, and the rest of you slum it on the grass at the front. So how things change, and indeed our cultures do change, and there is no possibility that we could order the church back to a community fast or to community charitable action. We just don't think like that. Our society doesn't work that way. So we can't go back, but what we can do is to say to ourselves, all right, we no longer celebrate Advent for 40 days. We only celebrate it for about 3.5 weeks. We no longer celebrate Lent as a communal fast and a charitable action. We celebrate it in a different way, but we can ask ourselves these questions. What is the point of Lent? What kind of fast are we keeping? And what does it do for us and for others and for our community? If it doesn't do anything for us, we should pack it up, quite frankly. If we don't know what we're doing or why, and there's no reason behind it, then why keep this ritual going? But I think there are things in the thread of what Lent and Advent are all about that are really important. I've spent a good whack of the last 2.5 years writing 2 books, one about Advent and one about Lent, and covered some of this these questions in my own mind in the preparation for that, thinking, well, what do we do then in the 21st century? How are we going to keep a fast? And one of the things that I began to come across more and more as I was going through my research and preparation was that there is another kind of giving up altogether that is nothing to do with chocolate or biscuits. It's got to do with a drawing closer to God in this way. And it's a thread that runs all the way through the theological writings of Christians right back to at least the 3rd century, and also through the texts of the Bible, that people, in order to draw closer to God, had to give up this thing, their existing ideas about God. The God they think they already know, they have to give up in order to discover the God that is. And so I decided to make that the kind of the theme of my Advent and Lent books, and understanding the beginning of things from looking back from the end, and what it means to give up. And I'm so away from, I said I'd do this, 2 pages in and I'm off my notes already. So we all bring our baggage, our perceptions of what we think God is like to our faith. And we do it without even realizing it. We think that we know some things about God, but actually what we've brought with us is ideas we've picked up from what we've read or misread, things that we've heard in scripture lessons or sermons or stuff off the telly or all sorts of things that we hear about faith and or we mishear. We think we've heard it. Perhaps we didn't really hear what was being said, but we think we did. And ideas we pick up in relationships, authority structures, and those kinds of things. Good ideas about God that we think, yeah, that's what God is like. Or bad ideas that we think, oh no, maybe God is a bit of a sergeant major, and that's, you know, I'll need to keep God at arm's length. So we bring these ideas with us, and they're all our personal baggage. And the hardest thing in the world is to sort out, you know, which bit of what we've picked up is good and we should keep, and which bit needs to be sifted out. Now, I'm going to drop the history lesson at this point because I think it's much more interesting just to pick out 2 of the people that I found most inspiring as I was writing my 2 books. When they had their mind changed by God. These 2 people have sort of stayed with me as stories that that kind of guide things I've done since. And the first of these is Abraham, and particularly the story of Abraham where he walks up the mountain with his son Isaac in order to make a sacrifice. Now, many of you, I'm sure, will already know the story, but in case you don't, this is how it goes. Abraham, having walked with God for some good long time and found the promised land and waited for his promised son, who didn't arrive and didn't arrive and didn't arrive, and then late in life, the longed-for son arrives, who is then the heir and is the key to all of God's promises being fulfilled. This son Isaac arrives. And by the time we're in Genesis 22, Isaac is fairly grown up, it seems. And God, we're told, calls Abraham to go into the wilderness up the mountainside and to sacrifice his son to God as an act of worship. And when I say sacrifice, what I mean is kill him, put him on an altar and burn him. So not a nice story. And Abraham goes up the mountain, takes his son with him. Now, what we need to bear in mind here is that Abraham lived, we think, probably between 1,000 and 1,900 years ago. That's quite a big window. But in order to date stories like that, you have to sort of find all of the other names and events and match them up with other old texts and sort of figure out how the picture fits together. And the further back you go and the more thin the on the ground the texts become, the harder it is to make a match. But there are various options as to where you can put Abraham, and he's somewhere between, he's either 1000 BC or 1900 BC or somewhere in between. So it's a long time ago, let's put it like that. And it is thought that at the time Abraham lived, that in the neighbouring religions, child sacrifice was a very common practice in religious ritual. And so for Abraham to hear God say, take your son and sacrifice him, probably wouldn't have sounded as outrageous to him as it does to us. So that's a little bit of background. But I want to ask the question, was Abraham hearing God speak to him? Or was he hearing what he thought God was saying? That's a question worth asking. Because sometimes we think we know what God is asking of us, and we have to sift out, is it what God told me to do, or is it what I think God told me to do, or is it what somebody else has told me or persuaded me, my subtle manipulation, that it's what God wants me to do? And in the story itself, it says that this was a test, that God was testing Abraham. So we assume that he's testing Abraham to see whether Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son. That's the kind of the clear interpretation. But perhaps there's another way in which he was being tested, which was to find out whether he really understood who God was. Let's leave that hanging in the air. There's some great paintings of this story, incidentally, which I've been researching for something else that I'm writing. And the same sort of pattern emerges in paintings in art galleries all over the place. And you get Abraham sitting in the middle with his long, flowing, grey, curly locks, looking kind of wise but rather anguished. And he's got a knife in the air, ready to strike. And then there's poor old Isaac lying there, bound hand and foot, with his throat, you know, exposed for the knife. And then in the top corner, there's an angel, and on this side, there's a ram caught in a thicket. And as the story progresses, Abraham makes the altar on the side of the mountain. He puts the materials for the fire around it. He then turns to Isaac, and Isaac says, "So, you know, where's the sacrifice?" And it begins to dawn on him, "Oh, my goodness. It's me." And so he binds him up, gets ready for the sacrifice. And at this point, an angel says in the King James, of course, that's what angels do talk in, "Lay not thine hand upon thy son. Lay not thine hand upon thy son." And so Abraham stops, and the angel points out that, look, there's a ram conveniently caught in a thicket, so you can sacrifice that instead. And that's what they do. Now, there are traditional interpretations of this story, and they're very good ones. One is, as I said, that God is testing Abraham to see whether he's prepared to sacrifice the thing that means the most to him. And when he sees that Isaac is prepared to do so, then he lets him off the hook and everything is all right. And that's a very good interpretation. There's another one, which is that this is like an allegory or a picture in advance of the sacrifice that God made in sending his own son to die for our sins. And so there's another thing, and that's a very strong Christian interpretation of the story. And again, a very good interpretation. And by saying what I'm just about to say, I am not saying that those are wrong. I'm just saying that stories have layers. Sounds like Shrek, doesn't it? But you know, stories have layers, and they do. And you can have those interpretations and park them on the shelf for later, but you can also have other interpretations that run alongside them. And one of the things that emerges powerfully to me from this story is this, that there are sacrifices that God does not ask of us. And sometimes I think that Christianity can be extremely harsh in the way that it's presented to us. Now, I am not here to suggest to you today that we go for a sort of leisure option Christianity and make it all nice and easy, and if it hurts too much, you know, just don't worry about it and stay in bed a little longer, ease off, everything's going to be all right. If you're going to be a Christian at all, if you're even interested in Christianity, then the only way really to figure it out is to give yourself to the project, and it is hard work. But even Jesus, you see, was quite contradictory in the way he talked about this. Because on the one hand, he would say, if you want to be my disciple, take up your cross, which coming from Jesus is quite a heavy thing to say. Take up your cross and follow me. Deny yourself, take up your cross. Somebody pointed out to me once that he did say take up your cross, not the cross somebody else has made for you or the cross that somebody else should be carrying. But by the by, I still think it was quite a strong word. Deny yourself. It's not saying have an easy life. And yet the same Jesus who said that also said, my yoke, you know, that thing that animals wear on their shoulders. My yoke, said Jesus, is easy. And my burden is light. So on the one hand, he's saying life is going to be tough if you follow me. On the other hand, he's saying it's okay. I'm gentle. I'm easy in my soul. So there's a contradiction going on. If we take that contradiction back to Abraham, maybe we read Abraham a little too harshly. And I think it's quite valid to say that we can read in this story the lesson that there are sacrifices God will not demand of us. And if they are sacrifices that lead to death and destruction, or the death of your soul, then you can hear the angel calling, lay not thy hand. Stop there. Don't do it. There's another way to go about this. Don't sacrifice your soul. Don't put something to death because you think God said. Just stop and wait. Sometimes people are committed to churches for long periods of time, and it becomes a dying thing in their soul. A friend of mine, wonderful man, I've known him since I was a very small child, and we grew up together. And he belonged to a church in a village in the southwest of England. And he belonged to the church, not because it was a great church, it was actually a very problematic church. But he believed absolutely in the principle that if you had a local church, you should belong to it and support it and make it work. It's God calling, don't worry. And so he went to this church and he struggled through, and little bit by little bit, you could see his soul beginning to die. So eventually, he decided that just to save his own soul, he would have to get some relief from this situation. Started to drive 10 miles away to go to church, to a church that was less his tradition, actually, but there was a lightness about it. And little bit by little bit, my friend started to come back to life. And after some reflection, he said to me, you know, he said, I did all of that for a principle, and I still think the principle is right, and so do I. But he said, it wasn't right for me, and I should have gone sooner. I shouldn't have let myself die as much as I did before I left. Sometimes we find ourselves called to ministries. You know, you might be a youth leader or a vicar or a reader in your church, or you might lead some house group. Or there's all sorts of ministries that we get called into, and it's good and right that we carry them out. But down the line a bit, what if that ministry is beginning to cause a serious toll on your family, on your kids? Lay not thy hand upon thy son is something I've heard ring in my ears once or twice. Don't sacrifice your kids for your ministry. You have to weigh these things up. And what I'm not saying is, you know what, guys, you know, here's a new recipe. Here's a new principle. I'm not saying there's a principle. I'm saying that if we are not to see our souls die, then we have to learn to discern in the situation and say, which of these things is God? Is God asking me to sacrifice here? Because he might be. But is God saying to me, stop, there's another way. And there's a ram in the thicket and the angel's telling you to stop. It's a liberation if we allow ourselves that. I don't know whether you know the poetry of Wilfred Owen. Wilfred Owen was one of the First World War poets, and he wrote the most amazing and poignant poem based on this very story. And he begins with the words from the King James Version, that Abraham set out and he clave the wood, which, you know, is just beautiful poetry. I love that. And he got the altar ready. But then Owen starts to go into the language of the First World War. And instead of altars on mountainsides, we have parapets and trenches. And you begin to see these young men who've gone to war as being the Isaacs who are laid on these altars of parapets and trenches. And then he says that the word came, lay not thine hand upon thy son. And proceeds with that line of thought. And Owen, like Sassoon, towards the end of the First World War, began to believe that although the war had been about something at the beginning, it was now being protracted for this reason, that nobody could give up the pride. And it had in the end, it was about not losing. It wasn't actually about the thing it was about. And so they wrote some searing stuff about that. And Owen's poet ends with two of, I think, the most poignant lines in the English canon. And after you hear God call and say, lay not thine hand upon thy son, he says this: but the old man would not so, and slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. And sometimes I think that's what we do to ourselves, because we don't hear the angel. I'll tell you a story about me, and then I'll tell you a story about somebody else completely. But there's a little story which I think is interesting, and it might help you to think about who your angel might be. Because I don't know about you, but I've never seen an angel with wings flapping inconveniently to tell me what to do when the chips are down. But I did, when I was training to be an Anglican priest long, long ago, get sent off for counselling. And I was really pissed off about this because It was part of the training, you see. We went on this counselling course, and the rules were you were not allowed to learn how to do counselling unless you yourself will go into counselling. And I'm like, you know, but I don't have any problems. I don't need counselling. What's this all about? However, I submitted myself to the course and off I went. And this remarkable and wonderful woman was assigned to be my counsellor and just gently and gradually began to pick off the layers of things I thought about my life and my situation and so on. And she was remarkable for this reason. She was not a Christian, but she knew a great deal about Christianity and was deeply sympathetic to people of faith. She was not there like, you know, a new atheist style, let's annihilate everything about faith that there is for fun. She was just about helping me to think about what I thought about my faith. And very gradually, she began to unpeel with me the layers of why I was doing what I was doing and how I'd arrived at this idea of calling from God. And piece by piece, I began to realize that some of it was so much part of me that I could no more walk away from it than I could poke my own eye out. But some of it I'd picked up along the way, and it had to do with the religious culture that I'd emerged from and the baggage that I'd picked up along the way. And still in the back of my mind, although I didn't realize it, I was hearing the nightmare missionary that used to come to our church when I was a teenager and tell us about how dreadful it was in Africa. I mean, it's not dreadful in Africa, but she used to say it was. And how, you know, terrible it was because it was so hot and there were diseases and there were bugs and snakes, and it just sounded so appalling. And in my 14-year-old brain, stuck out there in rural England, I began to think, oh no, you know, what if God calls me? It'll just be so awful. And I just, please don't call me. But on the other hand, I really wanted God to call me because I was so excited about God. And this great sort of, you know, tension built up in my head. And it went into this large box, which was very badly misnamed in my head, Africa. Many years later, of course, I had the chance actually to go in real life and found out it was a completely different scene. That's a whole other story. The point was that in my head, this thing had been set up that the call of God was a terrible thing, and that if you get called by God, something bad will happen to you. So my angel was a woman who had nothing to do with the faith, but objectively and gently and lovingly helped me to unpick the pieces until I could see what I was born for and shed those layers of deadening call that were asking me to sacrifice my soul. Let me move along, because this is another story. Excuse me, one moment. I need some water. There is another story, which, as it happens, is also about a sacrifice. But I can see at least seven people here from my college, and all of you will recognize this one as one of my favorite things that I'm always banging on about. But, you know, you'll love it, won't you, to hear it again. This is the story of Elijah. And Elijah the prophet is famous for a number of things. But perhaps his most famous story is this one. There is a long famine and no rain in the land. And then one day God says to Elijah, you go to King Ahab and show yourself to the king, and then I will send rain and the famine will come to an end. And so Elijah sets off, and rather than going directly to the king, I'm not sure why he does this, but he ends up having a big conversation with another prophet. But then eventually he gets to Ahab and has a big conversation with the king. And in the course of this conversation, Elijah rather intriguingly says to the king, I, and only I, remain as a prophet in Israel. That's verse 22 of chapter 18 of the first book of Kings. Then the conversation goes on, and Elijah then says to the king, call together all the people of Israel and all the prophets of Baal, because we're going to sort out the problem that this country has been in for quite some time. And the problem is this, that the people dither all the time. For 5 minutes, they worship the God of Israel, and then they turn around and they worship the local regional gods. And then they go back to worshiping the God of Israel, and then they turn away again, and they worship here and they worship there, and they don't know who they're following. And this is the cause of all our problems. And if we can sort this out, then the rain will fall and the famine will end. Well, Ahab calls together all the people of Israel and all the prophets of the Baals, who are the local gods, and they meet on the hillside. And then Elijah goes into serious showman mode, and he says to the prophets of Baal, right, you have that side of the mountain and I'll have this side. Set up an altar and put the wood all the way around it, ready to make a fire, and get a bull to sacrifice and lay it on the top of the altar, but don't light the fire, and I'll do the same. So they set about this, and they set up their altars, and they put the bulls on top, and they put the fire around, and so on. But they don't light the fire. And then Elijah says, right, you go first. Pray to your gods, and make them light the fire miraculously. So the prophets of Baal spend all morning and half the afternoon praying and praying and praying, calling out to their gods, and nothing happens. And then Elijah says, right, my turn. But before he sets about praying, he calls on his people, and he says, come on, chaps. Gather round, bring some water, pour it on the altar. So he douses all of the wood around his altar with water. And he says, come on, do it again. And do it again. So three times over, immense amounts of water drench this altar. So it wouldn't light even if you had fire lighters. And then he starts praying to God. Says, come on, God. Calls down fire and calls down fire and boom, the whole thing ignites. How dramatic is that? And then Ahab's wife, the murderous, wicked Queen Jezebel, hears that the prophets of Baal have been overthrown on Mount Carmel. And so she sets out with her chariots and her armies to chase down Elijah and kill him. And Elijah was not only impressive, he was also intelligent. And so he legged it and ran away into the wilderness, running for his life. And after about, I can't remember how many days it says, 4 or 5 days or something. Anyway, he gets to the middle of nowhere, and there's a juniper tree, and he falls down under the tree and says, enough, Lord, let me die. I can't do any more, and crashes out and goes to sleep. A little while later, he's woken up by an angel who shakes him by the shoulder and says, wake up, you need to eat. And the angel has brought him cake. I like this angel. Cake and water in a jug. So Elijah sits up and he eats the cake and he drinks the water, and then he lies down and he goes to sleep again. Sleep, 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 sleep. And then the angel wakes him again and says, come on, Elijah, you need to eat and drink more cake, more water. And then he gets up and it says that he goes for 40 days. Where have we heard that before? 40 days on the strength of that food and didn't need to eat again. Whenever you read 40 days in the Bible, it means that it's a time of preparation for something. That's why we have 40 days in Lent. That's why Advent used to be 40 days before we got a bit limp and started cutting it down to 3.5 weeks. And 40 days is about preparation. So Elijah has a period of preparation. Then he ends up in a cave, even more in the middle of nowhere. And in the cave, God speaks to him. And God says, what are you doing here, Elijah? So Elijah looks up, he says, well, God, I've been very jealous for you. I've been so faithful to you. And then he says the same thing that he'd said to King Ahab. I and only I believe in all of Israel. And then a great wind breaks out, huge tornado-y kind of wind, very dramatic. And we're told that God was not in the wind. And then there's an earthquake, and the earth shakes and breaks up, very dramatic, but God was not in the earthquake. And then it says there was a fire, but God was not in the fire. You know England's favourite hymn, don't you? Breathe through the heats of my desire, thy coolness and thy balm. Let sense be dumb, let flesh retire, breathe through the earthquake, wind and fire. That's the reference. O still small voice of calm. And what happens after the earthquake, the wind and the fire is that he hears a still small voice. Now, a really good translation of what it says in the Hebrew is a barely audible whisper. Something really, it's so quiet, you can't really hear it with your ears at all. It's that little voice in your head. So tiny that you have to be very still to hear it at all. And he hears the still small voice, and then he begins to hear what God had to tell him. I wonder, you know, why didn't God just do that when he was under the juniper tree? It would have saved a lot of faffing about. But I think there's a reason why he didn't do it under the juniper tree, because Elijah wasn't ready to hear him. And I think it was only after the experience under the juniper tree and the 40 days getting to the cave that Elijah was even ready to hear the voice of God. Because of this, because at the end of the story, what happens is that we learn that in fact there were 7,000 people in Israel who still believed in God and who had never worshipped the Baals. 7,000 people. And yet somewhere before this whole malarkey on the mountainside with the competition began, Elijah had already begun to believe he was the only one. And by the time he gets to the cave, he doesn't only believe he's the only prophet, but he believes he's the only person who even has faith at all. And he's beginning to believe, you know, that he has to be a superhero for God. And somehow this has become a bit of a deal in his brain. And God does bring Elijah back to the center very gently and very beautifully, but God pulls him back and says, no, there are 7,000 people in Israel and you have to go back. And then he tells him what to do next, and the story begins to flow on. Has anybody here read, I'm not changing the subject, has anybody here read Atonement by Ian McEwan? A lot of you. Have the rest of you seen the movie? Yes, some of you have. Atonement is a story that begins with somebody failing to understand what happens. A little girl seeing a sexual encounter and mistakes it for violence. And then a series of mistakes go on. And then she starts to write the story. And this sort of growing sense of relief that even though she'd made a big mess of it at the beginning, gradually the pieces were coming together and their lives were working out okay. And she's sort of hoping for the reconciliation. And each chapter opens up another layer of hope that reconciliation might happen, and so on and so on and so on, until you get to the last chapter. And then suddenly you discover something in the last chapter that makes you think, oh no, that's not what was happening at all. The whole story that I thought was happening wasn't happening, it was different. And only when you read the end do you understand the beginning and the middle. And I think that's true of Elijah's story, because you know why? We always imagine that this competition on the hillside with the fire and the Baals and the big, you know, miraculous lighting of the altar was a great success story. So I'm going out on the heretical limb here. I don't think so. I think that Elijah got sucked into a competition that was more to do with him needing to be a superhero and believing his own publicity. Because when you read the end of the story, what does it say? God was not in the fire. God was not in the fire. And if you read that back and you look, and if you read right from the beginning of the story of Elijah, what you'll find is this. Every single time Elijah acted in as God's man in the job, the story began with, and the word of the Lord came to Elijah. The word of the Lord came to Elijah. The word of the Lord came to Elijah. And so it goes on. But in 1 Kings 18, there's a bit of a slip. It begins, the word of the Lord came to Elijah and said, go to the king. But in verse 22, he says, I and only I am the prophet in Israel. And then he gets into the competition. I just wonder whether he should never have had that competition. But certainly whether he should have or not. He was then in the desert and he needed God to bring something back to the center, because he should not have been a superhero. And the point about the juniper tree is this, that before God could speak to Elijah, he had to simply meet him as a human being. And Elijah had to find himself again as a human being. He needed to eat and drink water and go to sleep. And those of you who've come from Robinson College know that as your chaplain, I say this repeatedly. You know what you need to do? Don't pray more. Don't start staying up all night revising and then come to chapel in the morning. What you need to do if you're in desperate straits is this. Eat proper food. Stop going to the bar and drink lots of water or tea instead. Smiles around the tent. Eat, drink and sleep. Because we are human beings. We're not superheroes. And if we want to do anything useful for God, We have to be human beings first. And God couldn't speak to Elijah until, first of all, Elijah had eaten and drunk and slept and got some rest and begun. That in itself restored his perspective. When I was a much younger woman than I am now, I used to be a worse workaholic than I am now. And I learned something about this lesson from a monk. I had been working very hard. I was a musician and singer-songwriter in those days. And I'd done a huge round of venues and a couple of tours. And then I'd gone to some Christian festival somewhere and done a bit of, you know, worshipy stuff. And I was really quite tired. But also I was a bit bruised because I'd been at this festival and I'd been told that I can't remember what I'd done wrong, if I'd said something too liberal or my skirt was too short. I forget. But, you know, I was told off for not doing it right. And I remember coming away from that and feeling a bit sort of, why do I do this? You know, what, it's just really not right, and a bit rattled in my soul. And it so happened that the next thing I was doing was to go to this monastery for a week of retreat. And I'd never been there before, and I was a little kind of intrigued to see what would happen when I got there. When I arrived, I was met at the door by Brother Robert. And Brother Robert showed me around the monastery and where everything was. Here's the chapel, he said. You can come here for services. Here's the dining room. You can come here for meals. And then he showed me to a room, very simple little bedroom. This is where you can sleep. And then he said, now, what are you going to do while you're here? So I said, well, I thought I might read quite a lot. And I know you've got a nice library. So can I go in your library? Well, he said, we do let people go in the library, but you look very tired to me. And he said, I don't want you to work. I'm thinking, work? I just want to read some books. Ah, reading is work, says Brother Robert. Okay. He said, I'll let you read, but only for an hour a day. So I said, well, you know, the hills are beautiful around here, and maybe I could go walking in the hills. Ah, said Brother Robert, well, you look very tired to me. And I think you should limit yourself to walking in the garden. So I'm thinking, I'm going to be here a week. What am I going to do? Anyway, I thought, well, okay, walk in the garden, we'll see how it goes. So he said, well, I'll leave you to settle in, and I'll see you at supper, although I won't be able to talk to you because we don't talk at supper, we just have stuff read to us. But I'll see you, and let me know if you need anything. And he turned to go, and as he reached the bedroom door, he suddenly turned round in the doorway, and he said, and by the way, don't spend all your time here praying. In fact, I suggest that you don't pray at all. Because you look very tired to me. And he said, I believe that you are not here to pray. You are here so that we can pray for you. And I cannot tell you, you know, I had come up until that point from a sergeant major spirituality where if anything was going wrong, obviously it was my fault and obviously I needed to work harder. And it was just like being lifted out of the front line of some war and being put on a stretcher and somebody saying, it's okay, we'll look after you now. And that, I think, is what happened under the juniper tree for Elijah. He needed to eat and drink and sleep, and so did I. So I leave those things with you today as the fruits of the best bits, I think, the bits that have stayed with me from the books I wrote. And there are sacrifices that God will not ask you to make. And you have to be human before you can do anything else. Amen. Told we have time for a few questions or comments, so if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, then you may. Or you may rush off to the bookstore and make my publisher happy by buying the book. She's more beautiful and much younger than I am, and she'd be very, very pleased if you do that. Hello. I'm sure it's a great question.
Sometimes people are not so good
actually an excellent question. Oh, we have a roving mic. Modern technology, I love it.
It was interesting you were saying about being human rather than trying to be superhuman, and the nature of an event like this, you come and you hear so many great speakers doing so many great things, and each one is an expert at a different thing, and you get built with so many ideas. But how do you feel, like, when I only became a Christian 2 years ago, and the first thing I heard God say to me was, let go, just let go and relax. But where do you get the balance between being and doing, kind of, as a Christian, and where do you feel that... How do you feel that the being and doing works in your life to best fulfill God's purpose through your life and stuff?
Being and doing. Doobie-doobie-doo, as Frank Sinatra said. I think in part it has to do with personality. I won't tell you the whole story, but you could read the story of the Transfiguration. Which was the one where Jesus goes on the top of the mountain with his three of his disciples, and two of them fall on their faces and say nothing in the presence of the prophets that appear and the glory of Jesus. And Simon Peter stands up and says, what shall I do, Lord? Shall I make you some tents? Would that be a good idea? And, you know, you just read through, and John the mystic, he always sits by and doesn't say much, but then he writes a brilliant book later, and Simon Peter is always up on his feet, what shall I do, Lord? To some extent, I think it is an issue of personality, and the way that you respond to God will be out of who you are. So some people will tend to do more, some people tend to reflect and think. And again, I think it becomes a matter of discernment. But I've learned over time to listen to my friends and my students, who sometimes say, you're looking rather tired to me. and I do tend to do too much, actually. And the last 3 or 4 years in particular, I've had to learn a great deal about just saying, you know what, if I don't get this great thing done, the album done or the book written or the whatever it happens to be, that's okay, that's okay. I just, right now, what I need to do is spend the day with my son and not think about it. And like the theme of the festival, you know, live in the now, live in the present day. It's not a very good answer, is it? Sorry about that. And I think, actually, a bit like this question over here, it's a bit about weighing it up and thinking, okay, well, I think that's probably the right answer for now, so I'll do that. I'll be, or I'll do. And see how it works out. And ask people. I do think we need to walk this thing, you know, in groups of people, in community. Because going back to the thing I said at the beginning, you know, we celebrate our spirituality in a much more individualistic way than people have ever done, ever. And we tend to feel we have to figure it all out. Well, we don't have to. We can work it out in groups and with friends. And that's what church is all about. Well, it's what it should be all about, anyway. One quick question, or comment, or something. No, you're all looking rather, sorry, there's a lady over here in the blue.
Hi, my name's Aisha. Hi. I was just going to ask, I know you were talking more about sort of conceptual giving up, but it occurred to me at the moment we're in Ramadan, we're in the month of Ramadan, and in the Muslim community there is a actual giving up. There's a fast, and it's a fast the whole community partakes in. I was wondering if you thought there's anything the Christian community can learn from that, the fast and the giving up that occurs in Ramadan.
I do find that giving up as a community an inspirational idea. I don't know that it's possible to rediscover that entirely as a whole Christian community, but I do think it's possible to rediscover it in local communities to some extent. And I know there have been really interesting movements within parish churches or individual churches of one kind and another, where whole groups of people have signed up as a community to an action or a giving up or a taking up, actually, sometimes, but a taking up in the sense of taking up a charitable cause. And I think that action as a community is a very powerful statement about what we believe and about who we are as communities. So I had two au pairs a few years back, one after the other, both of whom came from Muslim families. And we talked extensively about Ramadan. And my son and I adapted our life around those habits. And I found it profoundly moving, actually, to become part of that. So, yeah, I think we could learn a lot. But what I'm not sure about is how we could implement it other than as in local communities. Thank you. Good question.
That was fantastic. Let's just thank Maggie again.